So why and for whom is conversion helpful? Historians often speak of the conversion of European peoples to Christianity as if it had been an inevitable process. It is true that the first centuries of the Middle Ages are characterized by a continuous expansion of Christianity outside the borders of the former Roman Empire. What do you find? But that expansion wasn't always a linear process. In new Christian countries, Scandinavia, the Slavic world, Hungary, there were also episodes, especially in the 10th century, which can be considered as pagan reactions. Of course, such a wide-ranging trend and such a successful one can't be explained by a single cause or a single factor. Nevertheless, it appears that the political dimension, that is, the interweaving of the conversion process and its use as an instrument by the elites, is a key to understanding and apprehending the success of that trend. The Christianization of a population means the upheaval of its references and ways of life, particularly as it has an influence of its conceptions of time and space, and on the way family structures are organized. Both aspects can indeed be identified as spots of resistance in most missionary narratives at all times. Conversion also means breaking with the memory of ancestors, particularly when it is connected with sacred places, both in this world and in the other one. We know the story of the Frisian prince Radbod, Chris had explained yesterday. We rejected baptism as soon as he learned that, once baptized, he would never meet his pagan ancestor in the other world. That is why we may say that Christianization is a radical process of social refoundation. We can't underestimate the disruptive effects of the intrusion of Christianity, or more generally, any kind of monotheism, which is the basis of cultural otherness, into a sound system such as that of polytheism, whatever its actual nature. Jan Assmann showed that monotheism represents a cultural revolution which consists in creating a distinction between what is true and what is false. It creates a kind of cultural otherness which is not compensated by the possibility to translate a deity into another one. This practice is common to all kinds of polytheism, relying on a common stock of cosmic deities, and for which the very idea of a false religion is utterly impossible to understand. What Jan Assmann calls the mosaic distinction creates something radically new, a religion which rejects anything that came before and anything that came from outside, a sort of counter-religion which does not act as a medium for intercultural translation as the other ones do, but which works, on the contrary, as a medium for building cultural distance. If so, then why? Whom and what does the conversion of Northern and Eastern Europeans in the early Middle Ages serve? In other words, since we know that the process of conversion was almost only top-down, what advantage did the elites find in supporting that process, and how did they do it? I do not have the pretension to answer the whole of this huge question within the time of this talk, and that is why I will focus on a few aspects, taking my examples in several border eras of 7th to 10th century Francia. And this is why I will extend beyond the limits of Francia and Northern Europe under consideration in this session, as the dilatatio regni under the Carolingian and the first Ottonians necessarily brings us on the edge of the Slavic world. And I will talk of Bohemia. The first one, of Bavaria and Bohemia. The first aspect which seems important to me is the question of the link between missionaries and royal Frankish power. If you consider the narrative presenting missionaries from the 7th century on, you will rapidly observe that most of them were in rather bad terms with royal Frankish power. Some of them have had to fly before it, as Columbanus and his disciples did. In Dagobert's time, several of them were even forbidden to go and preach beyond the border of the realm. The mission did not consist then in making the non-Christian population pass under the domination of a foreign king, and Christianization was not seen as a means of conquest. This is clearly shown in the case of Hesia, a strategic region of extreme importance for the Franks. From the beginning of the 8th century, they had been creating fortresses there in order to secure the border with the Saxons, but they had undertaken no systematic conversion of the country, even if they had founded numerous churches, often manned by Irishmen. This was precisely one of the reasons of the conflict between Boniface and the world Frankish clergy. On the other hand, clearly no action was ever possible without the support of the local elites, except, of course, the active search of martyrdom. It is true that, on the Germanic margin of the Frankish world, a martyr such as St. Kilian of Würzburg, killed in 689, was primarily a victim of part of the elite's refusal to comply with new norms, especially in the domain of marriage law and sexual morals. These themes are also to be found in the case of the confrontation between Columbanus and the kings of Burgundy. Nevertheless, those early missionaries, often described as Irishmen or Aquitanians, also met with real support from the aristocracy. Indeed, aristocrats could use their acceptance of Christianity or even their adherence to a more radical form of Christian practice as a mark of distinction and also as a new means of identity and power building. To a great extent, building aristocratic power rested on the possibility to capture and to organize to one's advantage the places and poles of sacrality created in the context of the new Christian religion, that is to build family churches and monasteries. This movement began in the heart of 7th century Francia, continued into 8th and 9th century Germany, and into 10th century Central Europe. Its main characteristic was a new perception of space, now governed by the implantation of poles of sacrality, resulting in the creation of a new Christian landscape. Whereas Christians as professed until the 4th century the greatest mistrust for any veneration of a place, a sacred topography was set up as a result of the sacralization of specific places. Incidentally, and contrary to what is often said, those places did not always take over pagan sacred places, as John Henry Clay splendidly showed in his study of the conversion of Asia. And I can, you are the Frau Holle cult seat and the nunnery of St. Mary in this border of the Frankish land. And we see that the two sanctuaries are distant for a couple of miles. I know that your Converting the High Network already held one of these conferences on the question of landscapes, and I don't want to be superfluous, but I think it is important to underline how the Christianization of an era gave the aristocracy new means for controlling space to their own advantage. By founding monasteries that were able to capture the sacred powers in the countryside, by building family churches that could prevent the division of inheritances and which created an identifiable power center around family towns, and a small community responsible for praying for all deceased members of the kindred. We may mention many examples from the heart of Francia with Jouarre in 7th century to the easternmost margin of the Frankish world. I will here give two examples taken from the cartularies of Freising and Passau in 8th century Bavaria. First, the story of the foundation of Rottal Münster. Near the Hin Valley, is told in the Carta given by Irminswin to the church of Passau between 799 and 791. We can read the Carta of the handout. We read that Wilhelm, Irminswin's father, founded in the time of Duke Hugbert, that is around 728-736, a cellula in Viri di Silva for Sanctis Monialibus, living there under the rule of Saint Benedict. This mention of a Benedictine rule seems me a bit suspicious in this time and in this region, but it's not the theme in the moment. Then, with Duke Odilo's consent, he transferred to the cellula his hereditary property of Cuba, Hereditasua, only 2 miles away, putting the wall in the hands of his daughter. As she felt that her last hour was near, she called for Bishop Baltry of Passau. Yeah. Now, Rotal Münster here, Passau, the bishopric. Here at the cross from Inn and Donau. She called for Bishop Baltry of Passau and for her kinsmen, who gave their consent for her leaving the community to her niece, Sapientia, who would have to be succeeded by Ima. The bishop would only take possession of the cellula in the third generation, even if her minuet placed the whole community under his protection and that of Saint Stephen, patron of the Cathedral Church of Passau. She also asked her kinsman to inform King Charles of her decision so that he can implement her will. The document ends with a long clause threatening all her kinsmen who would not stand by her will. Let them answer to Saint Stephen and to King Charles, who actually confirmed that charter probably during his stay in Regensburg in 791. Rottal Münster would be then the oldest family monastery in Bavaria, founded both in the middle of a patrimonial estate and in the middle of the woods, but also, as you can see on the map, at a strategic point on the road between the bishopric of Passau and the royal palace of Althuting. Yeah. It was in the hands of women of the family, and its sacred character prohibited its carving up in the successive divisions on an inheritance provided for by the law of the Bavarians. Here is now a charter of donation from 769 in which a widow, Keparhild, gave the Bishop of Freising all the property she had inherited from her father and from a marriage dos, a dowry, on which she had founded the Church of Frauenberg. Here. With a star. Keparhild belonged to an aristocratic group linked with the Dukes of Bavaria and the Bishops of Langres, and whose possessions lead around Marching, a few miles south of her foundation. They were among the highest Bavarian aristocracy. The most interesting passage here is the one in which Keparhild alludes to the origin of the estate on which she has founded a church of Frauenberg. I quote, and I translate, you have the Latin on the handout. I, Keparhild, have joined in one place a property my husband Kunpato had given me as a legitimate dowry when he was alive, and a patrimony which I inherited from my father in the place called Gerbersbank or Frauenberg, where I founded a church which Bishop Abeo dedicated to Saint Mary Ever Virgin on the 13th day of the calends of February. That church worked as the main pole of sacrality for a marching basic kindred, which acquired thus more prestige and came in direct relation with the local bishop. Here, Bishop of Freising. Here's a good example of how woman's property could help building a pole of sacrality, which contributes to the fixation of territorialization of part of that kindred, whose branches extended very widely, as was common in the 8th century, to the Agilolfing ducal family, the founders of Scheffler here, the Bishop of Langres on the one hand, but also on the other hand to other Frankish kindreds of the Middle Rhine and maybe even to the Pipinids. Groups of these were so extended and their structure was so open that it's quite improbable that they were ever able to carry out a coherent policy. From those ancient groups, other kinds of groupings emerged in the 9th century, more limited, more ranked, and better rooted in a specific territory. I think we should pay great attention to the part that women's property, converted into consecrated property, played in this process of territorialization. There can be no doubt that creating the Church of Rauenberg contributed to structuring that era by polarizing it. The Christianization of space was one of the means for building a new kind of aristocratic power that can also be seen in 9th century Saxony, as Edwig Röcklein demonstrated. If we go up one notch in the hierarchy of elites, founding churches still represents an important aspect how to build power. In this case, a kind of power that claims to be princely power, that in which is vested some authority or at least some superiority over the whole aristocracy. I will take here the example of 9th and 10th century Bohemia, an era at the crossroads of several missionary influences, where the foundation of churches was one of the means the Przemyśl dynasty, you can read here, used for building their princely power. We must keep in mind that Bohemia did not have its own independent bishopric before 976. That was a missionary country, where most of the clergy who served in the churches were provided by Bavarians, particularly those from Regensburg, whose bishop had authority over the whole region since 895. But there were also a Saxon who gave the first and third bishops of Prague, Titmar, and Tidac, and Swabian, who filled several monasteries with relics and manuscripts. The main goal here was to make a mark of the landscape with exceptional buildings, exceptional both through their sacredness and because of their architecture. The first churches were built in the 9th century, a fact certified both by archaeology and by the Legenda Christiani. We now think that its author, Christian, was a son of Duke Boleslav I, intended for a clerical career and raised in St. Emeran Monastery in Regensburg, and that he wrote the legend in the late 10th century. This Legenda Christiani tells a lot about the founding of churches by the Przemyśl dukes. Borivoj, along with the first church of St. Clement of Radek, which was probably a princely chapel, founded in Prague the Church of Our Lady as a thanksgiving for his victory over Stremir, the chief opponent to Christianization and to the Moravian Alliance. You can see here on the plan, the number one, archaeological traces of the church have been found. It was a small building of 8 by 6 meters, with only one nave ending in an apse. And contrary to St. Clement, that new foundation was intended for public worship in the Civitas Pragensis. And Christian ended the story of Borivoj's work with these words, I quote, so did the first founders of holy places, the first gatherer of clerics, even modestly, show himself the institutor of religion. It means that the prince was responsible for instituting religion by gathering clergy around himself and founding holy places. His successor never ceased to do so, despite the change of political line which took Bohemia away from the Moravian orbit and submitted it to the Eastern Frank around 895. It was probably on that occasion that the prince Spitinef built a new rotunda dedicated to St. Peter, a few kilometers from Prague in the forest of Budec, is number 3 on the build. There, Bavarian missionaries developed a Latin school. It's more than probable that the foundation of this church happened at the time when the Przemyśl took possession of the fortress, which they seem not to have controlled before the early 10th century. Christians thought that this foundation and the role of Spitinef's religious policy were imitated from his father. I quote, imitator of his father, he proved a founder of churches of God and a gatherer of priests and cleric. Each of the following dukes would also found at least one church. Ratislav had the church of St. George built in the city of Prague. between 915 and 921. It was larger than any other and the only one with a basilical plan. You can see here, not so good, but the first city of Prague with this church of St. Mary and the Basilica of St. George. Maybe this Basilica of St. George was used as an episcopal church when the bishop or a representative, an archpriest or a core bishop in charge of Bohemia came to celebrate Mass in Prague. It was also built for receiving the tombs of members of the ducal family. Wenceslas had the relics of his grandmother Ludmila transferred here. She has been murdered in a castle of Trentin and he venerated her as a martyr. The Church of St. George was then very closely linked to the dynasty. As for Wenceslas, he also considered his duty to build his own foundation following the example of his father, as he told Bishop Tutto of Regensburg. I quote Christian, "In the past, my father built a temple of the Lord in honor of St. George, and I, with your consent, I burn with the desire to found a similar one in honor of the blessed St. Vitus, martyr of Christ." That church here dedicates to St. Vitus, of whom you had acquired a relic from the monks of Corvey, is a tetrachon rotunda, the rotunda with four apses. It was intended to become a funerary church in which Wenceslas also asked to be buried. His brother and murderer, Boleslav I, indeed fulfilled his request and had his body transferred from the castle of Stara, where he had died, to the church of St. Vitus. Let us remind you that Wenceslas was murdered in his brother Boleslav's princely residence, Stara Boleslav, at the end of a feast held on the occasion of the consecration of a new church founded by Boleslav and dedicated to St. Cosma and St. Damian. Unfortunately, no trace of the church has been found. Finally, let us give a last example. Boleslav II had a new church built in 976 in Pilsen, another power center of the Premish League. It was one church with a protruding apse dedicated to St. Peter, which still stands nowadays. Each of those churches was then found by the Premish League dukes within one of their fortified residences, and it also appeared that they often were new residences. But contrary to their ducal palaces, which were always made of wood, even in Prague, all those churches were built in stone, and several of them were rotundas. They were built as reliquary spaces of dramatization of a princely power. Their round shapes demonstrated its universal character and its superiority over all other power. So churches contributed to the construction of a prince's power and made it possible for him to control space and to mark it through the construction of exceptional buildings. Moreover, contrary to what is often thought, those buildings did not take over earlier pagan sanctuaries. It is true that there were sanctuaries in the 9th century established inside fortified enclosures, but all that network was destroyed precisely during the phase when the Premislites took power and encouraged the birth of new centers, sometimes only a few miles from the earlier ones. So the princes demonstrated their power to found new holy places in centers which were often centers of both political and religious power, which means that the prince was in charge of the sacred following the pattern set by the Carolingians and then by the Ottonians. But of course, the Premislites were not the only founders of churches in 10th century Bohemia. Their direct competitors, the Slavnikites, these are St. Adalbert's kindred, did the same in Libice, their power center in eastern Bohemia, which included a fortress whose archaeological remains show that it was a real princely residence. There are a wooden palace here and a stone church, huge. Stone church were built around 950 following Saxon design. A large church, 27 meters long, 6 meters wide, with one nave on a pattern of Latin cross with an apse at the end. It seems to be the only one church constructed on this model in all 10th century Bohemia. If we look at this, we see number 6, the Libice. It is very different from the other one. The church was destroyed in the last attack of the fortress given by the Premishlid in 995, at the outcome of which all descendants of Slavnik were slaughtered. Libice then declined rapidly, so that later sources consider it as a mere villa. The control of sacred places, often linked to the reception of different groups of missionaries who could themselves be rivals, was then an important aspect of the competition between elites from the margins of the Frankish world in the 7th century down to the new Christendoms of the 10th century. Of course, control of the sacred as a means of legitimating power wasn't a new phenomenon. What was new was the use of a new kind of sacrality, which allowed elites to project themselves into a new dimension. Indeed, the foundation of monasteries, of family churches, of princely chapels, as well as the acquisitions of relics necessary to their consecrations, allowed the elites to integrate several networks, to establish new connections at the local, regional, and even universal level. Let us think of Rome as the absolute point of reference. In that way, the process of Christianization was also an opening up to the world which worked primarily to the advantage of the elites, who found means for integrating one of those networks and to launch themselves up to another level. A collateral consequence of that opening up was also the emergence of societies and groups which more ranked than before. Control and manipulation of Christian sacrality remained one of the essential dimensions of assertions of superiority by some groups over others, supplying one important element of ranking, even if, of course, it was not the only one. In that way, the process of Christianization also was an essential tool for the competition within elites, allowing the emergence of a new Christian elite connected with the elites of the old Christian world. I thank you for your attention.